Museboat Radio. Turn your muse on. Museboat Radio, Main Time. You can tune in at wix.com/museboat/multimedia every week from Sunday to Saturday, always at 10 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to listen to the regular scheduled programs on Museboat Radio. We are available 24/7 for your listening pleasure. If you're an artist or musician, you can submit your work to Museboat Interactive at any time. Just visit our website, wix.com/museboat/multimedia, and enter the artist section. Let all your friends know about Museboat Radio. Did you know Museboat Radio Chat is a great place where you can chat with the artists that you love? Every week at the same time, 10 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, Museboat Radio shows are on. You can find information about all the artists we play in the artist section of our website. Every artist has his or her own direct link to their official website or Reverb Nation profile, so it's so easy to choose who you want to listen to. All World's artists need your favor, and All World's artists deserve that. Vote for your favorite music on MBMC Top 25 Music Chart. Visit our artist section and vote for your faves. You can follow Museboat Radio on Twitter, like us on Facebook, or become a fan on Reverb Nation at any time. Are you an artist ready to release your next new song or album? Museboat Radio is a great place where you can invite people to listen to your new music for the very first time. Instant access means instant reviews. Museboat Radio, Main Time.
Hello and welcome to Museboat Interactive. This is Museboat Radio and you're listening to Creativity Talks. I'm your host, Martin Bell. I hail from a place in the northeast of England called Newcastle upon Tyne. I shall be inviting creative people from around the world onto the show to talk about their life and career. I'm talking musicians, actors, wrestlers, presenters, life coaches, gift wrappers, basically anything and everything creative. Join us in the chat room at museboat.wix.com/multimedia, always on Tuesday, to listen and chat with other artists, friends and fans, and to support fantastic music searched by Museboat Radio worldwide. You can log in with your Facebook, Twitter or other social media sites to meet new artists and fans.
This is Creativity Talks with Martin Bell. Informal, relaxed, and entertaining interviews with creative people.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Creativity Talks. If you can hear the traffic driving by outside, then that's because I'm in a different location. I'm actually in a hotel room in Yorkshire this week. I just want to say a big thank you to Supigato, one of my previous guests. Ever since he was on the show, he's been giving me a list of names as to people I could invite on the show to talk. And thankfully, a lot of them have said yes. A few of them have already been on. Judy Dybel, and also Maria Slavakova. So thank you, Supigato. To my listeners, please check out the Supigato show. It's a great podcast. He brings in all sorts of different music and puts it under one roof. I just want to point out that even though this week's guest has the same last name as my previous guest, they are not related. Before we go to our interview, here is a great track from the band Census of Hallucinations called Free Yourself.
Understand, won't you give a little kindness, help us all? My guest today has been involved in music since the 1970s. He's been part of numerous bands from Eyes to the Sky to Senses of Hallucinations. He helped form the cooperative musical enterprise called Stone Premonitions and hosted a radio show called Alchemical Radio for 15 years. The kids are at school, and I've been informed he's drank 15 cups of coffee. Please welcome Tim Jones.
Hello. Thank you for that wonderful introduction, man. Brilliant. But it's only, I think this is about my sixth cup of coffee.
Is there sugar in this coffee?
There is, yeah. I far too much sugar.
Before we came to the podcast, I was told a wonderful story by Tim. I wonder if you just mind telling us a shortened version, if you could.
Right, yeah. Well, one day, we have a hedge that is dying at the top of the garden. But this one day, there was a big woman, quite a big woman, lying on the top of the hedge. My son saw her through the window and he said, "Hey, Dad, there's somebody lying on the hedge." I went, "What?" And as I got to the window, she rolled off the hedge into the garden and was crawling around the garden trying to get out. And I thought, oh, right, she's obviously drunk. Fortunately, one of her friends came and sort of rescued her from the garden, you know. But it was incredible how she was being held onto the hedge by some unseen force, because God knows how she stayed there without the hedge giving way. But, yeah, it was peculiar.
So we thought, you know, David Blaine's got his next trick sorted.
Yeah, well, this is obviously some kind of performance art that's going on around here, which are just sort of catching on to. You know, I haven't tried it myself yet, you know. But,
if you're listening and you're on Twitter, tweet me at Creativity Talks. What is that that trend of balancing yourself flat on objects? I can't remember what it's called.
Sheer stupidity.
I thought it was called planking, but, you know, it might be called sheer stupidity.
Dangerous pursuits.
People have done it on all sorts. I mean, you talk about dangerous pursuits. I'm sure I've seen somebody on top of a very, very high building.
Oh, God, yeah. I tell you what, if you watch those videos on YouTube, you know, these kids climbing horrendously high buildings and stuff are just hanging off. You know, I suppose it makes them feel... I remember seeing somebody commenting that it made them feel more alive.
Yeah.
To be so close to death.
Yes.
You know, and this was just a young guy, you know, to have that kind of mindset, you know.
First of all, I wanted to ask where you're originally from, because doing my research, I found that a lot of your work was centred where I'm based, the northeast of England.
It is always great, as I said to you in an email, to hear a northeast accent these days. You know, the northeast is a really, having lived lots of other places, the northeast is one of the friendliest places on the planet, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it has a whole vibe all of its own. I know this for sure. And all I have to do is go back there for a day, and just the friendliness of the people and stuff. You know, I'm not trying to be patronizing, Martin. You know, I grew up in the northeast from being a kid, basically. I lived in Scotland before that, up in Dundee in Scotland. I was actually born in the northwest, funnily enough, in Wigan in Lancashire. And we generally followed my dad's job around wherever he was working, you know, which was traumatic for me, changing schools all the time, you know, and changing your peer group. It really did me no good at all as a kid, you know.
Well, it doesn't allow you to build any
confidence
with people.
That's right. That's right. Especially moving from Scotland to England as well. Here's the Sassenach. You know, and then by the time I got a Scottish accent, I had to come back to England again. All right, mate. You know, so like, it was peculiar, really peculiar. But I lived in Middlesbrough for a while too, and I lived in Newcastle, lived in Durham.
You talked about the sense of humour in an article I read.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I tell you what, as well, especially drummers are definitely a breed, and some of the most funny people that I've ever met have been drummers in bands in the northeast. You know, I don't know why it is, but hilarious. Had me on the floor.
So I was doing my research, and something that I noticed that you loved were the old record shops.
Yes.
And you mentioned, you know, it's such a shame that because of the way that technology has moved on, I mean, you had LPs, then cassettes and CDs, and then downloads. I mean,
yes.
Download, you don't even have to go out to get the music.
That's right. Well, you know, what I've found these days, you know, after running the label, really it's like a musician's cooperative that we run rather than a label as such, you know. I mean, I thought it was interesting. Recently they were saying they don't call it the music industry anymore. They call it the music business. They've had a downsize, you know. But you find that selling CDs is very difficult these days. Hard copy, selling any hard copy is really difficult because people want to just download stuff for free. I mean, I was speaking to a guy the other day who was telling me that there was nothing that he couldn't get for free, but downloading for free. So, you know, they might be looking for a specific thing, but if they can't get that, they'll go for something else, you know, that they can get free. So it's very, very difficult. I mean, the record companies are dying. The big studios are dying because of home recordings. You know, it's just utterly changed. It's a huge change in music these days, you know.
You talk of the atmosphere in those record shops. What was it like? Are you talking about a certain time period?
Yeah, well, especially in the 70s, early to sort of mid-70s. There were record exchanges all over the place, you know, where you could go in, you could take records in and swap them or sell them to the shop owner, buy albums. You know, it was just a wonderful thing going. It was like a gold mine, you know, going through the racks and see, you know, for instance, a lot of these bands you didn't see on the TV or even hear on the radio. You had to discover them in the shops, you know, and you would go by the cover. What the cover looked like, you know. I've got a friend who's a teacher in Belgium, actually. He's just retired. But he was saying that one of the kids lost all his songs off his iPod or whatever. Everything went. I don't know, quite a lot of songs. And my friend said, so what are you going to do? He said, oh, I'll just get some new ones. So not even the same, you know, there isn't the attachment to the songs as such. You just get some new ones, you know. It's just a sort of throwaway. When I was a kid, you know, it was something, it was almost like a religious experience, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I remember queuing up from 6:30 in the morning to get tickets for Led Zeppelin. It was first come, first served. They were all £1 each, you know, but, and seeing them was, even the PA columns were dancing. It was unbelievable, you know. There just doesn't seem to be that kind of vibe anymore, that atmosphere, you know.
In the intro, I mentioned that you've been part of numerous bands. I actually did a count. And my tally came to if I took into account the bands that you assisted as well.
Right, right.
I came out with 11.
Right.
Now, have they all focused on the same style of music, or has each one had its own unique identity?
Well, you would call it rock music. You know, I started off in punk bands in the Northeast. In fact, the first one I was in was Neon. They did a couple of singles and then, you know, became a tax loss to Warner Brothers. I joined Punishment Luxury after that, who were more successful, although that wasn't my band. I didn't write the music for that. I just played in them, you know. But they were kind of more new wave than punk. And then it was strange. Through the 80s, there was this almost like, some would say, cultural desert, apart from, you know, synthesized pop music. But there was also an underground scene going along parallel, which was getting no coverage at all. And things like psychedelic rock and progressive rock. And that came to the fore more in the 90s. Plus lots of, you know, the way that technology was changing, communication via the internet, you know, people being able to share music, all of that. And so I became involved with what was really a sort of underground alternative, progressive, psychedelic, alternative rock scene, which is now grown immensely, really. You know, there's no money in it, but it's very creative, you know.
Well, what I've done is to cover these different bands, I've planned 11 questions, and each question will be about each band.
Right.
Are you up for that?
Yes, this could take some time.
So I'll name the band and then I'll ask the question.
Right.
Eyes to the Sky. You were given your first opportunity to actually front a band as a singer and guitarist. What were some of the first lessons you learned about being a front man?
Knowing your limitations. And basically, because of everything that I said before about school and changing schools and everything else, it really damaged my confidence. But the one thing that I could really hold on to, and this was basically through the Boys' Brigade, we all used to sit, there was a group of us in the Boys' Brigade that used to sit around with acoustic guitars strumming traditional songs. That's how I learned the guitar in the Boys' Brigade. And so when everything went all hell when I was a kid, the one thing that I had was the guitar, and that gave me confidence. It was, I thought, this is something I can do. So Ice the Sky was the first band. It was a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine called Paddy, who invited me over to Middlesbrough to join this band to sing and play guitar. And it did loads for my confidence as a person. So confidence building, but also knowing what you can't do as well as what you can, you know.
Number two, Whip It. I believe there are only two Whip It tracks. Why is that?
Well, because Whip It were a sort of woolly hat band, you know, of that 70s sort of hippie-fied sort of thing, because this was pre-punk, you know. Same with Ice the Sky. It was more progressive rock, sort of centering on instrumental music, really, with vocals thrown in. The emphasis was on the instruments. And Whip It did long jam sort of music, you know. Head music. We played quite a lot of gigs, though. We went from the Guildhall in Newcastle, you know, they had the May Day gigs there, yeah, to playing old folks' homes. But I think that the old folks in the old folks' homes were so starved of entertainment that even progressive rock was going to entertain.
Just imagine their faces.
Well, it was weird sort of being confronted by all these, you know, old folks in wheelchairs and everything, you know, listening to this sort of heavy-ish music. But, they, you know, it was great. They were lovely people, you know.
Neon.
Right, well, Neon was the sort of breakthrough. Punk was just happening. We had all that sort of teenage angst and everything else, all the hormones and stuff, and wanted to play fast and furious music. We started off in Durham as a three-piece band, me, a guy called Paddy, and another, the bass player called Mark Dunn. And we played all over the place. We got signed to Sensible Records in Edinburgh to do a single. They had the Rosillos and Sad Cafe. Through that, we got a John Peel session. Through the John Peel session, we got a deal with Radar Records, a subsidiary of Warner Brothers, a guy called Martin Rushent, who's now dead. He did the Stranglers, Human League, lots of bands. We were kind of taken under Martin's wing. Did endless itineraries, you know, going down to London, doing strings of gigs, grossing about £15 with the van falling to bits, the PA falling to bits, you know. And eventually it became untenable financially to continue. So back in the Northeast, and we all went sort of separate ways, but carried on doing music together in different guises over the years after.
My question then is, exactly how fast did you play?
Fast. It was fast and furious sort of riffing, you know, with sort of snarling vocals over the top, if you can imagine. But it was really weird, because in the end, Martin Rushent, I read an article where he said we were taking on too much of a jazz-oriented direction. So, which he couldn't quite follow, but you know, it was heavy. Sort of, I mean, we were into bands like XTC and stuff at the time as well. You know, we were of that kind of period, and so it wasn't the three chord thrash stuff, because we'd already been playing for a few years before that. You know, so we knew a few more than three chords, which was difficult, because you'd be too punk for the heavy metal guys and too heavy metal for the punks. So we were in a weird sort of position.
In a limbo.
Yeah, yeah. But supported a lot of bands, you know, back then that became really famous, you know. Had a great time. We didn't become famous, but they did, you know.
The next one, and my next question. So it was Punching Holes, and you talked of a memorable gig, Steve Strange's The Club for Heroes in London. How did that go?
Sadly, Steve Strange died quite recently.
Very recently, yes.
Yeah. But the thing that comes to mind was the waitresses and the barman and everything were all dressed as either schoolboys or schoolgirls in Steve Strange's club. And it was a very, for young'uns, you know, going in there, it was kind of shocking, and it was full of really interesting sort of characters. Great place to play. You know, but Brian Bond was the singer for Punishment of Luxury. When Punishment of Luxury split up, Brian formed his own band called Punching Holes and asked me to join. So that's how that happened.
Punishment of Luxury. I read about a weird atmosphere created on stage. How so?
Well, Jimmy Gyro, the bass player, for example, a very, very funny guy. Jimmy could be a stand-up comedian. Hilarious guy, fantastic bass player. He wore on stage loads of makeup. He had long hair, loads of makeup. He wore a dress which had a sort of frilly bottom, sort of, I don't know, like shin down to his shins kind of thing. And it had pictures of children playing with a ball, I remember, or running around the hem, and hobnail boots. And he would they had a song which was a sort of minor sort of independent hit, really, called Puppet Life. And Brian used to put his hands over the heads of the musicians in the band and have them dancing like puppets. So you'd have Jimmy, you know, this crazy looking guy sort of dancing like a puppet. Amazing. I had to wear an umbrella hat, a ski mask, and dark glasses. Right, I couldn't see a thing. At all, you know, you were just hoping to God that the gig was going okay. You know? Crazy, mental.
Were you given a reason as to why you were
wearing that? Well, everybody had to be, you know, look mental, basically, you know. Great band. I mean, Neville Luxury, the leader of the band who wrote most of the music, I mean, he was a real innovator, highly underrated, really. They should have been, you know. I mean, they did. They were signed to United Artists and they had an album out and singles and stuff. But again, they never quite sort of broke through, you know.
I've just realised I've broken my rule.
What's that?
I asked a second question. Yeah. I said, were you given a reason why you had to wear it? Never mind. Somebody famous, you've featured in a 15-minute film for Channel 4?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, what happened was my mother saw an advert in the Evening Chronicle, I think it was, saying, would you like to be famous for 15 minutes? What you had to do was produce your own script for a 15-minute film and your ideas of what you'd like to do with it and submit a demo to a company that had an office in Newcastle called Strictly The Business. It was run by a guy called Jeff Wonfer, who used to do The Tube. And amazingly enough, they got back to me and said, right, well, we'd like to offer you one of the films. So I got a 15-minute film on national television on Channel 4. You could have knocked me over with a feather, you know.
I bet.
Amazing. I said to Jeff when we, because it was a lot of it was filmed in the City Hall. They hired the City Hall and in Newcastle. And, you know, I said, I'm not quite sure here, Jeff. What do you want me to do? He said, perform. You know, do what you do. But we did a sort of spoof of the, you know, the Robert Palmer video. What's the song?
Is it Addicted to Love?
Yeah, it is. We did a spoof of that. And they even painted the backdrop, tried to get that near enough. You know, we had to hire costumes for the girls, get the right guitars. Near as damn it. You know, because Jeff had done that video, so he wanted to recreate it. It was a joke, really. You know? But it was good experience, very good experience.
Moving on to the next one, The Rabbit's Hat. Where did you meet fellow member and female singer Terry B?
Ah, right. Well, we used, like I say, we used to play somebody famous, the live band, used to play around lots of venues in the northeast of England. And one of them was an excellent venue in Stanley, outside of Durham, a village outside of Durham, and it was called the King's Head. And Terry was working in there. She was also singing in a heavy metal band called Vagrant with a guy called Davey Wright. And we met and hit it off. We were friends and then started, you know, doing musical things together. Terry is an incredibly talented lady, and her forte is harmony, really, harmony singing. you know, you can overlay her voices and make, you know, she can sound like a choir. Wonderful singer, very talented artist too, you know. So, yeah, we started off doing songs on an acoustic. It grew into a band. And then eventually we were signed to a label called Demi Monde Records, which was run by a guy called Dave Anderson, who was the bass player in Hawkwind. He's been playing in the Groundhogs since then. But what was the other band? Amon Dull. I mean, if anybody knows about those kind of bands, they'll know those names. And again, it was a real shot in the arm, you know, getting signed to that label. He had a beautiful studio in Wales that we used to go to. The studio was called Foal. And it was great. It meant we could get our music properly recorded, you know. So we did albums there. And then Stone Premonition started, which was our own kind of label. And Rabbit's Hat went along with it, really.
Mr. Quimby's Beard, now not technically a band you are a part of. You helped them out on guitar on one of their albums. They released three albums with your label, Stone Premonitions. How did they get in touch with your label?
Right, well, we put an advert into a local listing magazine. I think it was probably called Boiling Point or something like that. It was a Newcastle-based magazine. And we were looking for people to get involved with this collective idea, you know. If a lot of musicians collaborated, helped each other with gear, you know, instruments and recording equipment and this, that and the other, if it was pooled, then everybody sort of benefits. And they replied, they're from Sunderland, they wrote me a letter, and we got involved with them, and they were a great sort of space rock band, like Hawkwind-y type thing, you know. So mainly the work I did with them was engineering, you know, which is the thing that I enjoy most, and especially these days, engineering, production, that kind of thing, you know.
Next one I want to mention, Body Full of Stars, teamed up with a keyboard player and one of Japan's leading jingle creators.
That's right. Well, Body Full of Stars was basically the three people out of Neon, Paddy the drummer, Mark the bass player, and me. Mark, Body Full of Stars was really Mark's project. It was sort of funky music, crossing over into pop territory in some ways. But Paul Ellis, the keyboard player, that was living in a flat with another guy called Martin Holder, who was playing guitar as well in Body Full of Stars. Sorry, there's loads of people involved with it. But Paul Ellis was working for Yamaha's research and development department, and he was also a session player. I mean, he played with Hot Chocolate. He toured the world with them. Billy Ocean, he did world tours with them. He was Alison Moyet's musical director for the live band. You know, he's from Durham, you know, but amazingly talented guy. And we were very fortunate that Paul was playing keyboards with Body Full of Stars. Now, because he worked in the London branch of Yamaha's research and development department, his sort of opposite in Japan, Yasuko, was doing the same job. And that's how they met, through the company. Got on like a house on fire, got married, now have they've got a kid together, and they live happily in London.
Census of Hallucinations I left till last because we're going to be playing a few tracks. Now, tracks vary in length. How do you decide on how long a track is going to be?
It's a very sort of organic process, if I may say that. It just sort of evolves, really. And Census of Hallucinations very much uses this modern sort of technology of sending files to each other to record. You know, you don't need people in the same room anymore. I mean, you know, the drums can be, Paddy now lives in New Zealand, so he can do the drums in New Zealand and send me files. John, the guitarist, he's in Essex. You know, we have a keyboard player in Frome. You know, basically we do it by files, and then I get all the files at the end of the day, that everybody's contributions, and then mix them all together, you know. So it's everybody's collective hallucinations sort of brought together, you know. But that's the current band. Census of Hallucinations has had the most success in the world we're in. And again, that's the psychedelic progressive side of things, you know.
Wow, there we go. We've made it through the 11 bands.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you moved from, you didn't move from music because you stayed within music, but you had a radio show for 15 years.
Yes.
Alchemical Radio. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, at one time there was a guy, it's like about 1999, who had a little station based in the south of England called Supernova Radio. Ian, he was called, although he went under many different guises. And he said, hey, you know, why don't you do a radio? Just be like doing one of your albums, do a radio show. So I said, okay, I'll try it. And then 15 years later, you know, so I'd never tried doing that kind of thing before, but I really enjoyed it. It's a lot of work, though, just listening to the material that people send and deciding what you're going to play.
So they would send you material, you would listen to it and decide what was going in the show?
Yeah, everybody's looking for airplay, especially these days. You know, everybody's looking for some kind of sort of exposure. And it's great. I mean, I've heard met loads of wonderful people through the radio show, you know. And another guy that, well, two people, really. Gary Lee, that runs StarshipOverflow.com, that is one of the most wonderful shows going right now, and it's really on the up. I recommend that people tune into the Overflow, StarshipOverflow.com, and AuralInnovations.com, AURAL-Innovations.com. The radio shows up there are fantastic. That's run by a guy called Jerry Kranitz. He's based in Ohio, and he hosts the Stone Premonitions website from Ohio, which again, he did. Hey, you need a website, I'll host it. You know, I keep meeting these wonderful people that do this kind of thing.
And if you're all nice to each other,
everybody wins, you know. And like I say, it's an organic process, so it grows, but it's people in it for the right reasons, you know, because it's not about financial reward. It's not about money. It's about creativity, trying to make the world a better place, you know, for rather than and getting music heard that hasn't had money thrown at it.
When you were doing the radio show, did you edit the show as well?
Yeah. You have to wear loads of hats. Yeah. I would have to sort out what I was going to play by listening to the CDs. It was weekly, so it was like a train coming down the track on a weekly basis. Get that music together, edit it, script it, what you're going to say, how do you get in touch with the band, contact addresses, this, that, and the other, and put the whole thing together and time it into an hour. You know, so it's very time-consuming and a lot of work, you know.
Did you feel that as soon as the last one finished, you were thinking, well, I've got to get started on
the next one? I was already on to the next one. Yeah, that's the way it worked. Yeah, especially if you were going through two or three different networks, because of course internet radio is, you know, it's just become it's everywhere now. And so you would do a show. So I would do I would call it Alchemical Radio, but it might go through two or three different networks, and then you would have to insert the IDs for those stations. So, you know, you could do one show, sure, but you had to edit it to suit the station it was going through.
Did you have to edit what you were saying, or did that stay the same?
Well, a lot of it could stay the same, but it would depend on the references too, you know, and what was going on at that station in that week or that month, you know. So you would have to sort of tailor it. It went through. There's a ship called the LV-18 off the Essex coast. Radio Mi Amigo, we were broadcasting from there for a while through Gary Lee, again, Starship Overflow. Radio6.com, not to be confused with Six Music. That's a station based in Scotland. Oral Innovations, like I say, KWTF in California, they took it for a long time. So it's weird, you know, I'm making these shows here at home in the UK and sending them to America to be broadcast on FM stations over there. You know, it's strange.
What is great is, even though the show's not going now, the episodes are archived.
Yeah, yeah.
So people can still go back and listen to them.
Yeah, I mean, if you just put Alchemical Radio into Google or whatever, you know, you'll find it there. Same for Stone Premonitions. Put Stone Premonitions into Google, you'll find it. We have a web shop called StonePremonitionsWebshop.com, but the main site is through Oral Innovations. That's oral-innovations.com/StonePremonitions. It's a bit long-winded, that one, but that's because they host the site.
Have you ever thought about getting the radio show going again?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I only stopped just before Christmas, you know, because of the amount of things going on. you know, I'm a single parent as well, like I say, with my son, James, as well. He's due to start secondary school. I've got all the different things going on with the musicians in Stone Premonitions and the releases that we do and all of that. I needed a break, Martin, you know, because my head was just there was just too much. And obviously things started taking away from other things and you can't give things your full attention. And so the radio show, I thought, right, I need to stop and take a break here, you know.
You can burn yourself out. And I think if you're at a point where you think yourself you're not giving 100%.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. That's it. So probably, you know, there'll be a space and I will do that. I mean, this is the thing with Starship Overflow I was talking about. I do the IDs for them, the adverts and this, that and the other. So I'm still doing voiceovers for them. I do voiceovers for other people as well. So I'm still keeping my hand in, and any music that gets sent to me, I can pass it on. So and that means I don't feel guilty about not being able to give it airplay. You know, because so, you know.
Yeah. You've got your connections.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's an international music network that's going on. You know, it's immense, really. You know, I mean, if we do a CD now, there are so many people to get it to where you know you'll get a response, where you know they'll play it, where you know they'll give it a review. I mean, in the old days, you know, especially 70s and 80s, we'd make demo tapes, send them to record companies who'd give us quite often wouldn't reply at all, or send us something, a compliment slip saying, close but no cigar, or whatever. And it was just very, very, it did nothing for your confidence or anything. But that was the only outlet back then, because the major record companies ruled everything, you know. But I heard a guy recently from EMI saying that if a band these days can create their own website, sell their own music and make all the money, why the hell do they want to sign to EMI? You know, so that is the case. It has changed utterly.
Tim, I've thoroughly enjoyed chatting to you today.
Same here, Martin. Thank you very much for asking me. You know, I really appreciate it. Great.
I've got one more thing that I'd like to mention. I'm a bit of a sci-fi geek.
Ah, right.
And one part of science I find fascinating is the idea of parallel universes.
Yes.
Every decision we make creates an alternative universe. With that in mind, I was reading the story from your childhood that involved you making a choice.
Ah, well, when I was really little, I was just, I don't know how old, before, younger than 8, I think, or something like that. I tripped and fell on a pickaxe in the back garden, and I put it through my cheek, actually. Ooh. And I had to go to hospital, and there was a lot of blood, as you can imagine. I mean, this isn't really very, you know, nice story at the beginning, but I was sat on the kitchen table, and I can still see myself sitting there. And my auntie, it was, came up to me and said, if you're a good boy, when we take you to the hospital, I'll take you. The shop was called Ganges, I remember. And we'll take you to Ganges after you've been to the hospital. We'll get you a present. So I was a good boy. I've still got the scar because it wasn't stitched, funnily enough. In those days, it was, but I've still got a scar. Mm-hmm. And we went to the shop, and the choices came down to a train set or a plastic Beatles guitar. And this was when we lived in, I lived in St. Helens, which was a suburb of Liverpool, really. And the Beatles were everything back then in the early 60s, as you can imagine. And I chose the Beatles guitar. Now, if I'd chosen the train set, I could have been a happy train driver, you know.
Somewhere out there, there's a Tim Jones who is having his time of his life on a railroad.
That's right. I see how you were getting to that. Clever question, Martin.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us, Tim. I'll let you get back to, I'm sure you're going to make the next cup of coffee.
Yeah, oh, certainly. I need another one now. And thank you very much. And I look forward to hearing more of your podcasts and wish you every success, Martin. Plus, I hope your hand gets better soon.
Oh, yeah. Let's explain that to the audience. Unfortunately, the other day, I was a bit foolish. I was closing a car door with my left hand, put my right hand on the side of the car, jammed my thumb in the car door. My dad came round And he said to me, "What's happened?" And I very casually said, "I've trapped my thumb in the door." Took my thumb out. It looked pretty bad, so I went to hospital, taking a little bit off the end of the bone in my thumb, but doesn't need an operation. It's going to heal up. It's going to be fine. So everything's good.
Excellent.
Yeah. I love it. We've ended this podcast with two stories of
injuries.
Of injuries. Yeah, yeah. The main point we want to get across is stay safe.
Absolutely. And don't lie on hedges either.
Don't lie on hedges. Yeah. And avoid clumsiness.
Yeah. Watch those car doors too.
Put the seatbelts on, but you know, when you get out the car, it doesn't stop.
Yeah, and make sure you take your seatbelt off before you get out of the car.
Otherwise, whiplash.
Yes.
Oh, Tim, thank you so much.
And well, thank you,
sure,
man.
We'll chat again soon.
Thank you. Cheers, man.
Take care.
Tim Jones there, a delight to talk to. Tim and I seemed to have a good rapport. The conversation was flowing, and I actually had a lot more questions, but no more time in which to ask them. I want to thank his son, James, for the technical setup on Tim's end of the conversation. Well done, James. We played a Census of Hallucinations track at the beginning of the show. It's only fitting to end on another. Until next time, let your mind flow and keep creative. This is Love You True. I love you true.